Welcome to the Sports and Torts Podcast, your go-to podcast for entertaining conversations on sports, law, and business. This podcast is powered by the J. Stein Law Firm, a personal injury law firm in Atlanta, Georgia. And now, here is your host, Joshua Stein.
What's up, everybody? Hope all is well to all of you listeners out there. We appreciate you spending this time with us today. Hope everybody also enjoyed the Master Tournament last week, my favorite week of the year. Appreciate everybody's continued support and the positive feedback we received from Lindsay Fourline's episode last week. Y'all are absolutely right. She's a complete and total badass. We have another complete and total badass with us today. Alyssa Haynes in the house. Alyssa is a lawyer in Atlanta. She has done both plaintiff's work and defense work, been doing defense work for about the last decade or so, and is currently the co-chair of the National Appellate Advocacy, I'm going to try to say that right, the National Appellate Advocacy section of her firm, Freeman Mathis Gary. So she's one of those smart lawyers. And little known fact, we were co-workers back in the day at Goodman, McGuffey, Lindsay & Johnson. So Alyssa, it's been too long. Great to see you. What's up?
You too. Yeah. I think we talked about the other day. You were in my interview with Luskin, which I forgot about initially, but that's hilarious. Kind of really full circle moment here.
I was thinking this is not going to be the first time I quote interview you.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, to the extent this is considered an interview, this is us just chatting, but you're absolutely right. What year would that have been?
God, I came to Goodman in, I want to say like 2015 ish.
Yeah, sounds right, because I was there till 2017. We worked together for a couple years, worked on the same team with Luskin.
I remember you coming into my office telling me you were leaving, too. Like, I vividly remember that, because I think it wasn't that close to when Edward said he was leaving, and I was like, both of you are leaving me.
So, how did I break the news? Was it a good way, a bad way?
I don't remember. I think you were just like, at this point, you're like, hey, I'm leaving. I was like, okay.
Here's some cases. Have fun with it. But I remember interviewing you, and, you know, we interviewed... Over the years, you interview a lot of people, right? And some good, some bad. You were one of the very good ones where, like, you left and, like, we got to hire her. We got to offer her a job. And very glad we did.
Yeah, me too. Great time.
You doing some interviewing now in your position?
I am, yes.
Are you one of those that have, like, these set interview questions that you have to ask everybody?
No, I actually hate interviewing people. I think it's so awkward. Like, I just don't like it.
I agree. My interview style, hopefully, if you remember anything about it, should be very just conversational.
Yeah.
You know, like, you got some of these people that I've been interviewed, and they have these questions like, if you were a tree, what kind of tree would you be? Or if you were a car, what brand would you? I'm like, seriously? That's how we're going to go about this?
No.
Not you.
No.
So what's been going on? What you been doing all these years?
Practicing law.
Yeah.
Ready to retire.
Yeah.
Like most of us, right?
Every day getting closer, huh?
Yeah, I like to think so, but yeah, I don't know.
Well, tell everybody who doesn't know you about your, you know, name, background, firm. I mentioned a little bit what you're doing, but who are you?
Yeah, so Alyssa Haynes, like Josh said, I am at Freeman Mathis & Gary now, running their appellate practice with a few other people. I still have a trial book as well, so I'm doing, right now I'm splitting my time between trial work and appellate work. The goal is to get rid of the trial work and go exclusively to just handling appellate work, which I am on that track. The appellate work is getting more and more prevalent, both in-house and external, and I just prefer it. You know, I'm kind of done with the days of discovery disputes and motions to compel and depositions. I'd much rather just have my little oral argument at the Court of Appeals and write my briefs and research and be done with it.
So I think I kind of remember that discussion with you way back in the day. I mean, I never did any appellate work back then, still don't. And we didn't do much at the firm. We did a little bit. And I remember you kind of hopping in and enjoying it and be like, this is kind of what I want to do. And I'm proud of you that, like, that was the path you wanted to go down, and you have found great success. So
shout out to Robert Luskin for allowing me. It was that Goodman. Robert had a case. So he kind of let me run it from start to finish. My first negligent security case, where he was like, just take lead. So we won it at the trial court on summary judgment. And then Robert's like, okay, handle it at the Court of Appeals. Handled it and won at the Court of Appeals, had my first oral argument, made Robert drive me to the courthouse because I was so nervous. And I think the Daily Report wrote in the article that, like, it basically sounded like Robert was my Uber driver, and he really enjoyed that part. Robert sat there very... Christy Tamaccio, I remember, would say, our paralegal would say, you know, that Robert looked very nervous. Like, I was like twirling my hair. She's like, stop twirling your hair. And Robert's just sitting there in anticipation, but won at the Court of Appeals, and then plaintiff's petition for cert to the Supreme Court, and it was denied. So won at all three levels. And I mean, essentially, I mean, I have to credit Robert for letting me do it.
I love it.
That case kind of set new law, and until the CVS decision, which took it all away. But yeah, it really launched my appellate career.
All right. Go Luskin.
I know.
I've cased with Robert still, a good friend of mine.
Oh, yeah, me too.
He taught me a ton too. Him and Edward Lindsay, I always give credit. And now Andy Goldner, of course. I always give them credit for really shaping my legal career.
Edward taught me how to try a case.
Mm-hmm.
He was the first person who taught me how to try a case. And I tried one with Robert too. So they taught me how to try
cases. We have very similar lessons. So very good. Now, I also remember about you, your law school experience in New Orleans.
Yes.
Love it.
I did. My dad's from New Orleans. Mm-hmm. So I spent, you know, when my parents got divorced, I spent half my kind of childhood down there. But not like people would think. I wasn't just like partying in the French Quarter. Like, I think I went to the French Quarter twice in law school.
Well, that is what people think.
I know.
Right?
I know. But people who like are from there or live there don't enjoy going. Like, we went if friends were in town, or like, oh, let's go to the Quarter. Or like, you know, let's go to Pateau's. But also, like, we would leave for Mardi Gras too, because the city shuts down. You can't drive anywhere. It's usually during finals time too. So I had a moot court competition during Mardi Gras. And I was just like, this is miserable. So then every other year we would leave. Yeah. But no, I love it down there. It's just a different world and it's great. Great.
Now,
experience.
I'm so mad at myself. Undergrad, Georgia?
Georgia.
Okay. I thought so.
Well, I went to Alabama for a year, which people think is, so, you know, we don't want to talk about that.
That's right. That's right. My wife did the same thing, Alabama for a year.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So I knew that about you. So.
Yeah.
All right. So compare the allure of downtown Athens bars, which is how I went to law school, with the allure of what New Orleans has to offer.
I mean, they're just different, you know? It's, I mean, again, people associate New Orleans with the French Quarter, but there's a whole uptown area, which is where the schools are, you know, the undergrad and the law schools. And they're very similar. I mean, they're college bars, you know? It's just a kind of different environment. I obviously think New Orleans has the better kind of beauty to it as opposed to Athens. But I loved my time in Athens, and I loved downtown Athens. It's just very different in comparison.
I was in New Orleans about a year ago. It had been a minute since I'd been there.
Did you go uptown?
I had a great time. We stayed just outside the Quarter. I should remember the name of the hotel. The old one's got the bar.
Carousel Bar.
Carousel Bar. Yeah. The name of the hotel is?
Hotel Monteleone.
Hotel Monteleone. Yeah. Very good. We went to Commander's Palace for dinner, mm-hmm. which is
excellent the name. Choice.
And then Restaurant Revolution is where we really enjoyed it. It might be new. I don't know if it's
I've heard of it.
You know about. But you can't go wrong with meals there. People still call you and be like, what's your recommendation for?
Sometimes, yeah. But I'm also such a picky eater that my recommendations really don't mean anything.
So. Yeah. And then you came back to Atlanta after law school?
I did, yes.
Okay. Started doing plaintiff's work, right? And introduced you to doing both. So did some plaintiff's work and then switched to defense work. So I've had a lot of people that have done the other.
Most people.
The other side, right? They start defense work kind of like me.
And then go to where the money's at, right? Yeah.
Well, people have their own reasons for why they make different decisions for different jobs and different sides. But what was yours? Like, what made you decide to go interview at Goodman McGuffey and ultimately take that job?
So I was doing, you know, volume plaintiff work. I kind of felt like a glorified claims adjuster, which, again, nothing wrong with claims adjusting. But I was eager. I was young. I wanted to try cases. And I was definitely not going to get that experience where I was. So I talked to friends who were on the defense side. And they're like, oh, you know, we try a bunch of cases. I was like, oh, really? Then when I interviewed with y'all, I got the impression that I try cases. And I remember within my first 6 months of the firm, I was trying a case, like a huge case. So I switched over to get the trial experience. And then, you know, I went to law school knowing I wanted to do appellate work. You know, I was on moot court. I competed. I coached teams. And the appellate market on the plaintiff side, as you probably know, is very saturated. You know, you have your kind of go-tos there's a decent amount of them. Whereas on the defense side, there were really only, you know, like one or two that I would kind of consider a go-to. And I was like, that's kind of my niche to go into. And it's been great.
Really smart, because it's hard as a defense lawyer to break into different insurance companies and get business, because there's just only so many companies and people have been doing it forever. I remember thinking that you were very, smart, deliberate, whatever word you want to use, about saying this is what I'm going to be doing and hold yourself out to do that, because there weren't, like you said, many options. So, am I right? That was a deliberate decision that you made?
It was, but I also had the benefit of, I wasn't really marketing necessarily to insurance companies. And I still, I mean, sure, I do indirectly, but most of my business is from other defense lawyers, or sometimes even plaintiff lawyers if there's no conflict. I've had a lot of plaintiff lawyers reach out and ask if I could handle an appeal for them. But it's really the Georgia defense lawyers who, you know, let's say they have a carrier, they have a case that needs to go up on appeal, they don't do appellate work, they're going to refer the carrier to me and make that introduction. And then that's how I end up getting the work. So I'm really marketing to other lawyers. That's how I've gotten most of my appellate work.
And you made those connections, correct me if I'm wrong, through like GDLA, going to conferences, going to conventions and getting involved with folks, right? Like that's one thing that I thought GMLJ did a lot of great things, but one of the things they did was encourage us and support us to do those things. And I remember you always taking advantage of it.
Right. No, yeah. GDLA was huge. Most of my connections have been through GDLA, and I, you know, co-chair their amicus committee and I have for years, which has really been great to just, you know, as, especially when I was younger, getting my name like on appellate briefs, writing a bunch of pro bono briefs, which I'm sure all of my law firms loved me doing free legal work, which I continue to do to this day. But yeah, no, it's been a very good source of business and, you know, great way to meet judges. But same with, you know, my state bar involvement with, you know, being president of the Young Lawyers Division a few years ago, serving on the state bar executive committee. Just, you know, constantly making connections in our
hard to find time to do it, but it's important.
I know.
Right. How do you judge, like, how do you spend your time in different areas, making sure that you still dedicate time to that?
I mean, I remember, so the state bar work, that was a 5-year commitment. So, you know, I ran for office and for those of you listening who remember, a very highly contested election, because I remember Robert was the one who came up with my slogan, which is "Let Haynes take the reins."
I remember that.
Do you remember that?
Hashtag let Haynes take the reins.
Oh my gosh. And thank you to Gibbon McGuffey. You know, they let me buy like pens and little, like koozies and whatnot. But yeah, I mean, that election was intense. But then, so, you know, you become secretary, you go on to become, you know, treasurer, president-elect, president, and then immediate past president. And then your last 3 years, in addition to doing the YLD work, you're serving as an officer on the executive board of the state bar, and very, you know, tons of various committees, like the disciplinary committee or the rules committee. Just there's so many committees and, you know, things that require your involvement. So it's basically like two jobs.
Right.
For 5 years, it was like two jobs.
Right. And you have to look at it where you're not getting paid for it necessarily, but you're growing as a person, growing as a practice, making these great connections. Probably helps you kind of in your cases too, right? Like thinking through things differently and hearing how other people look at it. I don't know. Am I wrong?
No, I think that's right, too. I mean, but it's also just getting to know other people in your community, your legal community. I mean, I met so many plaintiff lawyers who I ended up having cases against. Or, you know, you really get to know judges outside of the black robe of being a judge. And I think for me, as a younger lawyer at the time, that made me more comfortable arguing in front of the people that I knew outside of just them sitting behind, you know, a desk and with a black robe on. So I think that was, you know, invaluable to me.
And I know you're still going down to Mercer Law School and doing some appellate presentations for judges, right?
Oh, via Zoom. Yeah, no, Judge Dillard is great. He always asks a handful of us to speak at his appellate advocacy class, and we love doing it.
So. Is that an example of things that, like, you wouldn't have, well, you might have probably not had that kind of opportunity, but for involvement in organizations, as you put it, put you in front of these folks?
Yeah, no, I think that there's a lot of judges and lawyers alike who I may know just because I argue in front of them, or I may see because I have a case against them, but doing that work actually let me to have, like, build relationships with them, which I don't think I would have been able to otherwise.
Yeah, you always did a good job of seeing the long game, right? And I think a lot of people fall short on that, where it's like, okay, especially when you're billing hours, and it's like, okay, I've got to bill X hours a week to meet my monthly quota, which is my yearly quota. I can't spend 15 hours going back and forth to Savannah for this meeting, right? Because how are you getting credit for it and this, that, and the other? But you got to think 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, that's paying off for you, right?
Yeah, Douglas Burrell, I worked with him when I was at Drew Echol, but he would always tell me that exact quote, you know, play the long game. It's all about the long game. And he's right. I mean, it is. At the time, I had a problem. I mean, I was young. I didn't say no to anything. So I was just like, yes, I'll speak at this conference. Yes, I'll go to this. Yes, I'll do that. I mean, in hindsight, it was way too much. Like, I took on way too much. And, you know, it was a working every weekend, working till 2 a.m. type of thing, which isn't healthy. So now I've, you know, really gotten better at selectively and intentionally picking, you know, okay, do I really need to go to this conference? Like, do I really need to say yes to every speaking opportunity at this stage? Like, what's going to give me the most benefit?
That's the right progression. But I do think it's good to err on the side of saying yes in the beginning.
Sure.
I tell my kids this all the time, like, don't be reckless about decisions, but when in doubt, like, go do it.
Especially if the conference is somewhere fun.
Yeah. But even just like with everything in life, you know, it's like there might be a dinner that you get invited to that you really don't want to go to. I don't know anybody. I don't want to walk in there and be the person in the corner that has no one to talk to.
Sure.
And you make yourself go, and lo and behold, you will make a handful of connections that down the road will pay off. So when in doubt, say yes. That's
just
what
go.
I say.
Just go.
So you mentioned Drew Echol. Is that where you went from Goodman McGuffey before you're at your current firm?
Yes. So I was at Goodman for about 4.5 years, I think. And then I think I was at Drew Eccle for about 2 years. And then I've been at FMG now for 2 years exactly.
Okay. And each stop, you're learning new ways firms go about doing their business. You're making new connections and relationships. And all this holistically helps the practice as well. So have you found that every place you go, you're kind of pulling things, meeting new people?
Yeah, I mean, they've all been different experiences. So like at Goodman, I started, you know, even though I had practiced for 4 years, I was a plaintiff lawyer and had zero trial experience. So Goodman really taught me, in my opinion, how to be a lawyer and how to try cases. And then I actually progressed from, you know, junior associate to senior associate to eventually non-equity partner when I was at Goodman. Then I came into Drew Eccle as a partner. That's kind of where I started running my own, you know, and building my own book of business. And then, you know, now where I'm at Freeman, Mathis & Gary, I'm, you know, continuing to grow that business, but also running an appellate practice and kind of building out the firm's appellate practice. So yeah, they've all taught me very kind of distinct skills that I would continue to use today.
And can I give you a big congratulations for the promotion to equity partner
this year at the
new firm? That's that is no small feat.
I appreciate it.
So congratulations. That's reaching the pinnacle of having all your work pay off and having the firm recognize that. So that's awesome. So I tell you when we start, I don't have any cases with your firm, which is very sad. I need to sue somebody else's client sometime soon.
We joked about this when I walked in, you know, earlier. I told Josh that I think 2 days after he left Goodman McGuffey, as a insurance defense lawyer, we see him, like me and Robert see you posting on like Facebook or LinkedIn about like fighting for justice for injured people. And some of our adjusters were commenting on it too. And we're like, man, that flip switched really quick.
I'm a justice fighter. I mean,
two days later,
you can't go to bed one night.
Different person.
Look, I call balls and strikes. Okay. I see things as they are, good, bad, or indifferent. Facts are facts. I call balls and strikes. And now I got to fight for justice.
We fight for justice too on our side.
Tell me your definition of fighting for justice.
No, I mean, you know, people, I think there's a misconception, you know, oh, the big bad defense lawyer, you know, you guys just work for the insurance companies. Sure, the insurance companies pay our bills, but they're not my clients. My client is the insured. The insured is a person just like plaintiffs who are injured. And sometimes even the insurers are injured, or they too are going through a really stressful time with being sued and their mom and pop shops, you know, threatening to go out of business, things like that. Or young college kids. I remember a trial that me and Robert had. She was a high school senior at the time, and she was sued for a like minor fender bender accident, rear end collision. And, you know, she'd never been through this process. And like, we stayed with her from, you know, senior year of high school until when she was at Alabama, I think for like fashion was her major. And, you know, afterwards she posted this amazing review about me and Robert, just like how much she learned and like how grateful she was for us. But that's what a lot of people don't see, because they just see the big insurance company on the other side.
I'm not going to push back on anything you just said. I agree with you. I mean, that was my experience too. And I think that if I make this about me for a second, that kind of empathy that I understand the defendants are going through as well, I think helps me in my cases. Like when I take depositions of defendants, of corporate representatives, like you're not going to hear me yell and scream, make them feel like crap.
And many do though, which is just like amazing to me. And, on the same side too. I mean, yeah. You see a lot of defense lawyers do the same with plaintiffs.
And many do, but I've never found that was productive, nor was it like really the right thing to do.
Right.
You know, they feel bad enough if they have admitted they're responsible, they've admitted at fault. They feel bad enough they cause this anyway. They don't need someone like me to come in and make them feel even worse. I also get along with pretty much all the defense attorneys. I mean, there's always going to be a handful, but I think that serves us well too. I mean, that your approach, I mean, until having to be shown otherwise, like you're going to get along with people.
Some of my closest friends are plaintiff lawyers. I'm, you know, Kevin Patrick worked with us at Goodman McGuffey. I just settled a case with Kevin the other day. And I remember the second Kevin switched sides. I mean, we've had a lot of cases together, actually, and I've referred him cases. You know, another one of my good friends, Morgan Lindell, who's at Brendan Flanagan's office, you know, she too started with us. And then, you know, we get along great. I mean, it's just those relationships are important. And I think it truly does help you to settle a case too, when you're friends with the person on the other side. It just makes it less contentious. And I mean, you're still like fighting like for your client, and it's not like, you know, favors aren't being exchanged, but you're more understanding if somebody needs an extension, or if you're like, hey, give me what I need to show my carrier why this case is worth X, they're more likely to get it to me than maybe somebody I don't know or somebody at, you know, a firm that just doesn't care.
Right. So. No, totally. Absolutely. Okay. So getting back to your current day-to-day, great title. Chairman, National Appellate Advocacy Section. I messed it up in the intro. I have a hard time saying it. That's doing smart things. That's big work. So help us understand like the setup of the firm, like the kind of case you're working on, how you get involved in these things and what your usual, if there's such a thing, kind of caseload looks like.
Yeah. So we do insurance defense. We have a lot of different practice areas, I mean, ranging from catastrophic injury cases to cybersecurity to employment law to director and officer professional liability matters. So we really kind of do it all. And, you know, for my trial work, I would say, you know, my trial book of business is primarily, you know, auto accidents, catastrophic injury cases, a lot of negligent security cases, so gas station shootings, apartment shootings, things like that. And then I'm general counsel for a few different companies. So I just do kind of general legal work for those companies. My appellate work started initially as negligent security. Like I said, that case at Goodman McGuffey made new law, really, that helped our side up until Carmichael came out, the CVS opinion. And so that's kind of what made me get a name in the appellate sphere. So I was doing a lot of negligent security work. And then that kind of morphed into, I know Judge Dillard one time told me, I think I had an 11th Circuit oral argument over the summer in an employment law case. I had never done employment law. And Judge Dillard, who mentors me, and I really am grateful for that, he said, you know, appellate lawyers are generalists. You know, you can learn anything, you can do anything. And he was right. I learned employment law. I argued my first case at the 11th Circuit, and I won my first case at the 11th Circuit. So it has been, I've enjoyed that aspect of the appellate work. I think it's easier handling a case in an area of law that you don't know about on appeal as opposed to actually in the trenches in the trial court. So same thing, I just filed an 11th Circuit appeal involving a, you know, governmental law and constitutional law claims. Like, I don't normally do that type of work, but I was able to, you know, write a good brief on it.
So walk through how that gets to you. So an issue happens at the trial court that needs to be appealed one way or the other. And they look to you, and this is an employment case or a civil, whatever it is. You get what, a transcript, briefs that were written, orders that were entered, trials that were, you know, filled trial transcripts. And what do? You just start reading it?
So there's a couple different ways they come to me. Sometimes they're my own cases. So like I handled it, like I either won or lost summary judgment, and the carrier just wants me to handle the appeal because they know I do appellate work. So in that case, they already know everything that's gone on below. The other way is internal appeals for our firm. So what our firm, one of the reasons I came over to Freeman, Mathis & Gary because I thought it was so innovative is every single appeal in that firm runs through an appellate committee, which is me and a couple other attorneys. And every appeal has to be roundtabled before the brief is done. And everyone's given an opportunity to participate in the roundtable process. And then every appeal is mooted. So you do a moot court just like you would before an oral argument. And we decide, you know, whether the appellate committee is going to get involved or not. And if we are, we kind of try to divide it up between like me and my other partners who are on that committee. So those are kind of how we get the internal appeals, in which case, again, the trial lawyers in our office so we can talk to them and get up to speed about what went on. The other way, which is what I primarily do, is external appellate referrals. So either the trial lawyer lost a motion at the trial court and told the carrier to hire me, or there was a bad verdict, and either the defense lawyer or the carrier reached out to me saying, fix this. I'm the fixer. Right. In those cases, yes. So I have the defense counsel send me, you know, the trial transcript or the pleadings below and things like that. And if it's a verdict gone bad, yeah, I mean, I literally sit there on my iPad, get out like, you know, the little Apple pen and highlight it and read through the damn trial transcript.
And so what's the setup, right? Because like, I'm very bad at sitting there and reading through things like that. Are you sitting someplace where you're like in a nice comfortable chair, you've got a cup of coffee or some tea? Because sitting at a desk in a office chair looking at a computer, that is very tough sledding. Do you have a preferred method of getting through all this stuff?
I like looking at it on my iPad better, especially if I'm reviewing a lot of transcripts because I use TrialPad.
Gotta have good software.
Yeah. So it codes issues for you and just runs a nice little report. But no, I mean, I either do it at home or at the office. And I think if you're going into appellate law, you know, it's just that has to be part of your personality. You're kind of like coverage lawyers. Like I used to joke with Tyler. About like, how can you sit and work on one coverage opinion for 12 hours? And she's like, I love it.
Yeah, Tyler and Stephanie, they just love doing it. Like that's what they like to do.
But that's kind of the same for us. Like I thoroughly enjoy sifting through a trial transcript and finding out, oh, like this is an issue. Like this, you know, and kind of going through that.
Do you go in there thinking like, this is what I'm looking for? Or is it when I see it, I'm going to know?
So defense counsel will often tell me like what they think the issues are, but sometimes what they think the issues are, I'll look at it and be like, oh, you waived that. That's waived. You know, Court of Appeals loves a good waiver.
Yeah.
So there's nothing really we can do. But yeah, no, I go in with a fresh set of eyes and I try not to just like rely on what underlying counsel told me because I may find things. I typically do find things that they may have not picked up on because they're not looking for it.
So are you a wizard with like the rules of evidence at this point and procedure?
I mean, I'd like to think so. Yeah.
How do you keep yourself fresh and learning all that kind of stuff?
Trial and error. I mean, I do a lot of reading. I even starting at Goodman, I would just constantly buy books on topics, you know, and spent a lot of my own money out of pocket over the years just doing that, you know, watching trials, listening to appellate arguments, watching, you know, lawyers far more experienced than me handle appeals and reading appellate briefs. I would subscribe to, I don't know if it was through Daily Report or what it was through, but I would always get the updates on when a new opinion came out. And I would look to the ones that, you know, related to my practice area. And I would start, you know, posting on LinkedIn about how this new appellate decision, you know, affects my clients. Or I would e-blast it out to my clients. So like you kind of start learning things that way. And one of the things I didn't mention, just going back to what you said previously about how cases come to me. I do a lot of embedded appellate counsel work. So when I told you I was kind of trying to get rid of my trial practice, I'm not totally removing myself from it. So I get hired a lot of the times to be at trial as appellate counsel, basically to preserve error, or a lot of the times is to handle areas where things may go wrong. Like I handle jury charge conferences a lot, or motions in limine, or things like that.
I'm so glad you brought that up because that's what something that I was going to get to. Because I find that such a fascinating role for somebody. And am I wrong that it's kind of like gaining more traction recently? Like that's a much more popular and hot role to fill a trial? Or has it always been going on? I didn't know about it.
Definitely has not always.
But I feel like every trial now of any sort of significance has somebody like you on both sides of the table. And this word embedded is kind of a new word, if I'm being honest, to me at least. Mm-hmm. Am I right?
No, yeah. I remember back in the day, no carrier's ever going to pay to have two defense lawyers at the table. Like they're paying their defense counsel. Why can't their defense counsel preserve error type of thing? But now I think it kind of started with, you know, not just carriers, but then also, you know, just large corporate clients who are self-insured recognizing, and it all goes back to, you know, you get these huge verdicts and carriers and companies start thinking, okay, why is this happening? What can we do to prevent it? Or they're losing appeals because things are waived. Why is that happening? And can we get ahead of it? And that's where we come into play on both sides. And, you know, it's still a delicate balance. You know, sometimes you're hired as embedded appellate counsel and defense counsel is like, why are you here?
Yeah.
Like, am I not competent?
You're looking over my shoulder the whole time. I don't need you here.
And that happens. Like, I've had a lot of disagreements over that. And it's a hard thing to navigate. But then I've also had, I mean, more common that the lawyers, like, they love it because they're like, less work for me and you do what you're good at doing and I'll do what I'm good at doing.
That's where I fall. Yeah. It's like, if I could have somebody else handle the charge conferences and I'll make the motions in limine and make sure all the objections are preserved. Like, hell yes, thank you. By the way, I appreciate you not using the word nuclear to describe the word.
I was so intentional about not saying that because I know a handful of plaintiff lawyers that I'm not going to name who would attack me for using that phrase, and I'm not doing it, and we're not talking about it.
I know you well enough, and I know you're smart enough that you choose all of your words, and so I was going to throw that back at you to just say, very, very well done.
Very large verdict.
Very large verdicts. Yeah. So the whole embedded stuff, and you'll get brought in like the week before, or a couple
sometimes
weeks,
or
day before. Yeah, I've had people get pulled in like the day, like jury, trial starts on a Monday, like, oh, crap, coming on Tuesday and start work. Right. I mean, so it's you're thrown into the fire. And a lot of times you don't know any of the facts. You don't know who the parties are.
Right.
I guess the rules of evidence apply across the board. So you're in there just sitting and thinking, making sure this is done right.
And sometimes in those cases where I'm hired the day before, you know, I'm not counsel of record. So I'm not sitting at the counsel table. I'm just observing because I'd be in the best position watching it to, you know, figure out what the issues would be on appeal. But other times, and, you know, this is kind of a more newer thing for me, I'm hired at the very beginning. Like I'm talking about when the complaint is filed because the carrier or the company recognizes the risk involved in the case, or maybe it's who the other lawyers are on the other side. And I'm involved in working side by side with defense counsel through the entire case, starting with, you know, the dispositive motion stage, strategizing about evidentiary depositions. And that's where I think, I mean, there's a huge benefit there because you truly have the benefit of two lawyers looking at different things throughout the case all the way until either trial or appeal.
Uh-oh. I don't need two of y'all in my cases. that sounds scary. So sometimes in this podcast, I just assume that the listeners understand some of the words that we're saying, but we have a lot of non-lawyers listen to. So when you say like perfect the record or preserve things or waiving objections, like help people understand what that means when something goes on appeal and if it wasn't properly handled at the trial stage.
Sure. So during a trial, you know, there's certain objections you have to make. Let's say plaintiff or, you know, tried to introduce evidence that was not admissible because it either, you know, the proper custodian of that record wasn't there to testify or, you know, let's say there was something objectionable about what an expert witness said on the stand. If you don't, you know, we have very strict rules about that. And if you don't object, sometimes it will constitute waiver. And so if you fail to object to the trial court and then you're like, okay, we need to appeal this, but oh, wait, we didn't object to that coming in. Well, you can't argue that on appeal then. And there's very different exceptions, but
sure.
You know, that's the general rule.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you're trying a case, because I remember, I mean, I've tried plenty of cases as first chair and even second chair where you're not necessarily thinking about that, especially as a younger lawyer. I mean, that's definitely not what was on the front of my mind. You're so focused on trying your case and, you know, you're not necessarily thinking about, did I properly object the jury charge two times like you have to do at two different stages to properly preserve it in Georgia? And that's where the appellate attorney comes in to basically, you know, kick you under the table and say,
hey, come on.
Object, object.
Yeah.
And it truly allows the trial lawyer to focus on trying their case. And same thing, you know, if there's a important issue that comes up where the judge may want supplemental briefing on, you know, you're going to go back and you're going to be like, I need to work on my closing. I can handle that supplemental briefing so you can focus on.
I don't have time to write this brief
exactly.
And do this research and all that stuff. All right. Don't name any names, but when you get brought in after the trial to figure out on appeal, you know, let's say a big verdict and you're like, we got to figure out a way. And you're going through a trial transcript and you're like, well, crap, this person had this golden opportunity to make this objection and didn't do it. What the hell are they thinking? Like that has to happen all the time. So how do you not throw a person under the bus when you give your report about, hey, look,
You know, that happens all the time, like literally all the time. And I never fault the underlying lawyer for it, and nor would I ever throw them under the bus. But you just find carefully crafted ways to say it. You know, even if it's as simple as, you know, this wasn't raised at the trial court, so we just can't argue it. And I try to find a way to make it sound like, you know, there's multiple reasons why they may have not brought it up. You know, obviously I wasn't there, so I can't tell you what was going through their head. I'm sure they had a reason. It's always,
yeah.
I'm sure they
always
had a reason.
Yeah. Smart lawyer, experienced lawyer. Yeah.
Right. So like things like that. But sometimes the carrier already knows that the underlying defense counsel royally messed up because they were either at the trial or they've also read the transcript, in which case you don't really have to do anything because they know what the problem was.
Right.
And sometimes those situations, like those lawyers have already been fired, like from either working for the carrier or the firm. But yeah, it's a delicate line and you always want to just phrase it as, you know, you're in a different mentality as a trial lawyer and you're focused on other things and they had their reason for doing what they did. But I'm here to tell you that as the appellate specialist, this is what we can and can't argue now based on what happened below. So
very, very well said. Do you love writing? Love research?
Yes.
God bless you. Have you always?
Yeah, I've always loved writing. Always. Mm-hmm.
You have to doing the work that you do.
100%.
You have to. And you also have to love the research, which I'll do it, but I don't seek it out.
I will say I don't love blue book citations. Like I feel like maybe right after law school, you were like so like you got your little spiral bound blue book and you knew like how to cite things. Now I'm just like, I rely on the people who are fresher out of law school. Like when it was Morgan Lindell at the time, Morgan, if she's listening, will remember that she came to my office like super late one night At Goodman when I was trying to, or maybe as a Drew Eccle, to file an appellate brief, and she like came in and did my blue book sites. Cause like those are just things that the rules always change and it's hard. And
so are you one of these writers, like you're stuck in, you know, your thoughts on grammar, whether it be like two spaces after a period.
Put two spaces. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh, you're gonna give me a heart attack. If I see somebody put two spaces after a period, I lose my mind. Same with people who justify, like justify their text and make it all line up. Like, I know it looks pretty to some people, but talk to any judge on our bench and they'll tell you it's so much easier to read if it's not. And now the Supreme Court, thank God, has rules on that where they don't want it justified like that either.
And there are some other pet peeves I can take from you that will drive people crazy.
Don't use Times New Roman. Also, thank you to, I think, Justice Pinson, who led the charge in spearheading the font changes.
What's your beef with Times New Roman?
It's meant for typewriters. It's horrible.
So what is your preferred
font? Newspaper articles.
Georgia? No. Cambria?
I do last century school book. I also have read Typography for Lawyers. It's a great book, and it gives you a lot of great information.
So congratulations. Font being discussed in this podcast for the first time ever right now. What did you say you use? Century what?
Century School Book.
Century School Book. I'm about to look at this.
And that's recognized as one of the acceptable fonts now on the Supreme Court of Georgia's website.
That's actually kind of smooth.
And then Matthew Butterick's fonts in the Typography for Lawyers book, he has some fonts that you can purchase and download. I use Equity, which is one of them that looks very nice.
What about the way that you format things in terms of headings and subheadings and subheadings and all that kind of stuff? Or do you have a particular style?
I think that headings should be persuasive as opposed to just being like, you know, the trial court erred in holding X. Like, it should tell a story. I mean, I think the judge or the court should be able to look at your headings and just the table of contents and know what your arguments are going to be and be persuaded one way or another. I'm also big on introductions. If the court doesn't know in the first couple pages what you want them to do, I think you've lost them already. I am a big proponent of using pictures in briefs and diagrams. If it's something, you know, for example, if it's like a trip and fall case and you're saying that the plaintiff tripped on a ledge that was so open and obvious, why would you write that as opposed to show the court how open and obvious it was? I mean, that's more persuasive to me. And I think people are still hesitant to use pictures, but the judges enjoy that and is helpful. So I'm big team pictures.
So I'm team pictures too. I learned that from writing reports to insurance companies about what a case should be valued at and giving them the picture that I went and took at the client's restaurant that shows why it was open and obvious and put it right in there. So I do that with my demand letters now when I'm demanding the insurance companies and I show them
pictures of all those nasty injuries and that's bad property damage, that crushing damage.
Remember, I'm fighting for justice. Yes. And so to do that, I've got to submit all these things.
That's right.
I agree with you on the pictures. I've got one lawyer who we're going back and forth on some briefing and he just over pictures. I think you can over picture.
You can 100%.
I think just like everything else, you've got to be like to the point and succinct. I love what you said about using the introductory, the headers to make them explain and be persuasive and not just be throwaway words. These judges, these law clerks, they are busy. The quicker you can feed them the good information, the better off.
And the shorter. I mean, like, you know, I remember, I don't know what firm, I think I may have been at Goodman McGuffey, but there was a case, I think it was like a homeowner case, because Robert used to love giving me those and I hated them, where both sides submitted like forever long briefs. And the first thing the judge said when we all got in there is like, they are called briefs for a reason. They are supposed to be brief. And ours were like 50 plus pages. Theirs was 50 plus pages. So most of your appellate courts will have page or word limits.
Yeah.
But you don't need to take the full page or word limit. Just like an oral argument, you don't need to take the full 15 minutes.
Just because they give you 25 pages doesn't mean you have to use 25 pages.
Sure.
So oral argument, that's intense when you're up there in front of the panel of Court of Appeals, Supreme Court. I know you've done that. So walk us through the preparation, the mindset, getting ready to be peppered by questions from people that are pretty, they're high up in our profession, obviously.
I just talked to Judge Dillard's class about this because I remember I was also on a podcast with Scott Key, and I do what's called—
Whose podcast is better, by the way?
They're both great, and they're different in their own ways.
There you go. Go ahead.
But I do this case law chart where I and it's probably over preparation, but it helps me the best for brief writing and oral argument. Basically, I take every case that the plaintiff has used persuasively in their brief and I put it on a chart in alphabetical order and I put what they're citing the case for. I actually read the case and then put like the facts, the holding, and then I have another column as to how I can distinguish that case. And so that helps me to write the brief. But then an oral argument helps me tremendously so I can say, look, in these the 25 cases that plaintiff relies on, they all have this one distinguishing fact, or you can do little things like that.
So do you mean like demonstratively you use it to show that the judge?
No, or just use like it as I your use it you as use a preparation it. Tool. Okay. Yeah. And, you know, honestly, when people say, you know, law school doesn't prepare you to be a lawyer, and that's pretty accurate, but moot court in law school taught me how to do an appellate oral argument, hands down. And I was fortunate for that experience. And, you know, I've done a number of moots, you know, thankful to all the lawyers who've mooted me and helped me. And the countless, the good thing our courts do is our court appeals and Supreme Court archive all the past oral arguments. So you can literally sit there for hours on the weekends or at night, which is what I did, to watch how other lawyers did these things and to watch other oral arguments on issues that I was going to be arguing. And, you know, you start watching enough of them or going to enough of them, you kind of look at other people's styles, try to pull in that some pieces of those you want to be your own. But, you know, you kind of figure out what your style is.
I mean, this is a compliment, but you almost have to nerd out over it or nights at weekends and just kind of get all into it, which you were obviously into it and still are into it. It should help. All right. I have a dumb question that I've never asked anybody. I've always wondered, what the hell does the word moot mean and come from? Do you know?
No, I don't know.
Is it a Latin word? Is it something that...
Probably, and I took Latin and
Because obviously in law school, it's like, you can be on moot court. Now it's a verb. You know, you're gonna
I feel like I should know this, and I'm embarrassed that I don't.
Should we look it up?
We should Google it, yeah.
Should we look it up?
Yeah.
So let's say, what does moot mean in legal terms? Okay, so let's see what Google says. In law, an issue or case being moot... That's not it. That's not
that's
it.
That's not the right one.
That's not it. What does moot mean in legal terms for oral argument? See if that does it. Same thing, to render something moot. Well, that's not what we're talking about. It can also refer to arguing a case in moot court. Here we go. It can refer to arguing a case in moot court, the mock court where hypothetical cases are tried for the training of law students. Moot court is a simulated oral argument, similar to what's been made into appellate court. So maybe it's just a word that they came up with to...
Instead of like mock trial.
Instead of mock trial, it's moot. Yeah, I mean, because mock trial was always, you know, like a jury trial. Right. Like call a witness, do the thing. But moot was always the appellate. So
right.
We got to get to the bottom of this.
I know.
So the moot process, the way you used it, which is right, is other people in your firm or other colleagues that will act like the judges,
right,
and you will go through the process and they will drill you with questions you can expect. Am I saying that right?
Right. And, you know, you want to practice being drilled with questions, but also practice with them asking no questions, because sometimes you will get a cold bench where you might only get one or two questions. And it's not common, but I've definitely had that before. I had it on a Zoom argument during COVID. And typically what you want to do for the Court of Appeals arguments, at least, is if you're arguing at the 11th Circuit or the Court of Appeals, you're going to have typically a three-judge panel. And so you'll have three moot judges. But at the Supreme Court, you know, you have nine justices on there. And so I remember my first Supreme Court argument was when I was at Drew Eccle, and it was during COVID. So I was part of that first group of lawyers who did it by Zoom. And when I tell you, like, having to, like, control nine justices in little boxes, plus all the lawyers, plus amicus counsel, there was, like, you know, 15 people in Brady Brunch. And I was just like, oh my gosh, I don't know who's speaking. It was terrible. But
well, I guess if you get through that, then you can get through anything. Yeah. You know, I mean, what do you do with, you have this great argument prepared, you know, backwards and forwards, you got your outline. I mean, you described how you do it. And then the first question and the second question just throws you off in all sorts of tangents.
That happens all the time.
You have to prepare for that.
So you practice going out of order. And so you ask your moot judges too, you know, like, so when I do give my roadmap, I always start with like a roadmap of where I'm going to go. I'm like, ask me to start with my third point, or ask me to start with my second point, so I can practice transitioning back. And, you know, I always bring a nice little neat outline up with me, but, you know, most of the times I either won't get through it all or I will go out of order. You just have to practice controlling that and, you know, segueing back in or using one of the justice's questions or judge's questions to get you back to where you need to be. It's trial and error. Take practice.
Yeah. I've kind of gotten better at that through this podcast. Like, I put outlines together and I told you this, like to help me just kind of know the flow, but you never go in that order. And sure, so it's like, how do you take something that you may have said to let me weave back into a direction that I was planning on going? It's the same thing in those arguments. Like you've got your points you want to get out. Even if they're taking you a different direction, sometimes you've got to figure out a way to weave it back in.
And if you're the appellee, you also want to weave in, you know, what the appellant said in their arguments. So, you know, you don't know necessarily what they're going to say, because if it wasn't in their brief and they're saying it for the first time, you know, you have to be prepared for that. So, and same with rebuttal, you know, you don't exactly know what your rebuttal points are going to be when you get up there or beforehand, because it's going to depend on how the argument goes. Yeah.
How do you gauge your internal time clock or body clock to know, hey, I've got this many minutes? Like you said, you don't have to use it, but you can't go over. There's this many points I want to make sure I get in. Are you gotten to the point where you kind of now had that clock ticking where you go, okay, I've got to get to this point. I've got to make sure I get this in before I run out of time.
So I practice when I'm practicing my argument. Like, so I'm somebody who writes out every single word of their argument, like multiple pages, just putting it on paper. And then I'll condense it to like a short form outline, but I'll practice reading it all the way through, like, how long is my argument if I got asked zero questions? And I kind of based on that, and then you'll have the clocks in front of you telling you how much time you have left. And so there's creative ways to kind of, you know, if you're like, oh, I only have 2 minutes left, you know what you've already said and what needs to still be said. So you have to kind of evaluate, okay, I know I really want to like give this beautiful case example, but I don't really need that, but I do need to hit this point, and you just have to pick and choose.
How do you handle your eye contact with the judges and justices? Because you're looking down, you're referencing your outline, not missing, but you also don't want to be reading.
Yeah, so I try to really not look down very much. I mean, at the point of oral argument, I pretty much know my case backwards and forwards, and there should be very little that I need to like actually look down in my outline for. It's just there, kind of, it's like a safety blanket. But yeah, I mean, I do try to maintain eye contact throughout the entire argument, and you never want, just like at trial, you know, you never, the lawyer who like reads their opening or closing argument, the jury's all asleep, you don't want to read your outline, because that's just, I mean, you should be way more prepared than that.
Yeah, it's nails on a chalkboard when I see that happen.
Right.
Compare your nerves, jury trial versus appellate argument, if you can.
There are a lot different nerves. You know, I think you're always nervous. At least I'm always some level of nervous, which I think is good because that helps me over prepare. But I think it's just a different kind of nerve. I mean, trial is, there's a lot more, in my opinion, unknowns and things that could happen at the trial level as opposed to the court of appeals in my argument. Sure, I might get asked a question I don't know the answer to on appeal. But in that case, I can always say, you know, Your Honor, I'm sorry, I actually don't have an answer to you, but if you'd like, I can do a supplemental brief on that. At trial court, it's kind of different, you know? Yeah. If you don't know, like, a rule of evidence, or if you should object, like, you're kind of screwed on the spot. Yeah. So I think that there's different challenges in each of them, very distinct challenges in each of them.
Hearing you say to tell you know, Your Honor, I actually don't have an answer to that question. Like, that's hard for people to say, but you should say it.
People struggle with that. And that, I can't remember who it was that taught me that. I want to say it may have been Darren Somerville, who taught me how to handle if something like that comes up. And, you know, it is perfectly acceptable. First of all, you don't want to make something up in the record, or you don't want to pretend you know something you don't and then say a wrong thing on the record. But, you know, you can't know everything. There's going to be things that you don't know.
And it's credibility, right?
100%.
I mean, once you lose that, you kind of, everything else kind of falls apart. So I learned that too somewhere along the way. And I remind myself that it's okay to say something like that.
Right. Yeah. Happens.
Yeah. Now, how about, we talked a lot about marketing and the way you created contacts and stuff, but what about social media? How do you view that? Because lots of plaintiffs lawyers I have on here, we're talking about, you know, as you said, I was talking about fighting for justice. There's a certain element that you have to do as a plaintiff's lawyer, so people know what it is that you do and that you're able to do it successfully. How about from your perspective? How do you view social media in your practice?
LinkedIn has been invaluable to me. And whether it's just been, you know, posting about, you know, some of my appellate wins on there, or how a case of mine has changed the law, or even like I mentioned earlier about a new appellate decision that has come out and how it would impact my target audience on LinkedIn. And I've had several carriers or adjusters reach out to me saying, hey, I saw, you know, your post on LinkedIn. Like, I'm very interested in adding you to our appellate panel counsel. Like, do you want to interview? And I'm like, absolutely. So I think it is LinkedIn is a great marketing tool that people don't utilize enough, in my opinion. And I think it's fantastic to share those types of things, like those wins. And there's a fine line between, you know, the grandiose overly posting about like all of your success and wins, but if you limit it to like really landmark cases that impact, you know, your target audience or the people you want to be your clients, I think that's more helpful.
I think we all struggle with what you just mentioned. Do you have in your mind like a volume of what you try to do? Like some people say, I want to post every day. I want to post.
I don't want to
post
for that.
Every week. I want to post this. Like, is yours just, hey, when something is post appropriate, that's what I'm going to do it.
Typically so. And I, you know, as I go on and on in my years of practice, like I have less and less time to really do that. There's some people I know who post every day, and that's great that they're able to do it. I don't know if they have like people doing it on the side for them or companies. I wish I had that. I don't. So it really is just like, oh, this is a big rule change in the court. Like I remember I did a post when the Supreme Court changed their font justification and font requirements, because me
back
as a font nerd, I was so excited. And one of our associates, the firm, Carlos Fernandez, he likewise nerds out on that with me. In addition to, we're both nerds on mechanical keyboards. I could talk for like 5 hours about mechanical keyboards.
I don't even know.
Oh my gosh.
What question should I ask you about mechanical
Google
keyboards?
It. It's like I don't know.
Okay. We have that. We have that function here.
It's just like you can build your own like computer, like keyboard with like the switches, and some of them are tactile or some of them are, you know, like, and it's like the sound that the keys make, and you can outfit it how you want it. And like, I have the best mechanical keyboard in my office. So,
all right, we'll give a plug to whoever the manufacturer
is. It is Newfie. I think Newfie should sponsor me and give me maybe some discount codes. But no, it's there's a handful of us lawyers who are really big into these types of things.
Now, I'm all about a Bluetooth keyboard.
Well, yeah, they're all Bluetooth now.
But I'm saying like, in terms of that's how I like to my setup. Like I don't have a desktop, you know. So maybe I'm being very simplistic about this, but like I don't go much more deeper than just that.
Like I hate typing on my laptop, so I'll even use I have like a travel mechanical keyboard from Newfie that I use that's a lot like slimmer, and yeah. I'll bring it.
Does
with
this
me.
Thing like fold up in your backpack?
Yes.
And just roll?
Yeah.
So we got fonts, we got keyboards. What
you
else?
You have to find the what, little things in life that what, give you joy. Okay.
What else revs you up? Now, I do know that you told me that you're into music festivals these days.
I am.
And EDM, electric dance music.
Yeah.
Is that new, or is that something you've always been into?
I mean, I think I probably got into it around like 2015-ish. So probably like when I started becoming a defense lawyer.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, it is, some people, you either love it or you hate it. Some people think, oh, it's just the DJ, you know, pressing play. I mean, promise you it's a lot more than that. I'm, you know, friends with some of these DJs and know them personally and know what goes into it.
Yeah.
But no, it's just, you know, a great community of people, you know, traveling to awesome places to go to these shows. You know, they have festivals all over the world. You have the huge Tomorrowland Festival in, I think it's in Belgium. You know, you have some of these festivals in Croatia. You have Veld Festival, which I'm going to in August, which is in Toronto. So you get all the, you know, travel to all these cool places, meet places, people from all over the world. And yeah, I mean, I love live music.
So festivals, is it like a weekend event, couple days? I'm asking, I don't know.
It depends on the festival. So normally traditional EDM festivals are Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So those are hard because basically you're taking off of work Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday because you're coming home on Monday. So you really have to plan that ahead. But then there's tons of festivals too that are like 2 days. So like, you know, Friday and Saturday or Saturday and Sunday. There's even one-day festivals now in some places. But then there's also, you know, you don't have to go to a festival. You can just go to a show. We have EDM venues in Atlanta, you know, District, Tabernacle does some of them, like Roxy. And so if you don't want to do like a whole festival, you just, you know, go to a show on a Saturday night and mm-hmm. that's it.
Your thing.
Yeah.
And you said the community, it's people who you're seeing same folks at all these different places.
Yeah. It's just a really, in the EDM community, they call it PLUR, peace, love, unity, and respect.
Peace, love, unity. Okay.
And it's truly like a place where, you know, people like there's no judgment. Like, I mean, you see people wear anything and everything, you know, people big and small. Everyone is just very kind to each other. I mean, that's really the kind of community that this music has brought out of people. And yeah, I mean, sometimes you do see a lot of the same people, but it's just a common love for like the music itself and then just the environment and the people around you.
I was going to ask about the costumes and the decorations and the things of that. And that's all part of it.
Yeah, I mean, sure.
But, wear whatever you want.
But it truly is wear whatever you want. If you want to wear jeans and a t-shirt, wear jeans and a t-shirt. Nobody cares.
Yeah.
We're there for the music and the atmosphere. If you want to wear, you know, a themed costume, like a lot of these bigger festivals, people would do like theme days. I think they have like a what's called Groove Cruise, where it's like a 3-day cruise. Where all the artists, you know, play on the ship, and there's actually set themes, like, you know, a nautical day or a blast from the past, and you can kind of focus your outfits around that. But a lot of people use it as like a way to express themselves too.
So if I want to get into EDM, where would you tell me I should start? Like, what would be the first artist or song or?
It's hard.
Because I can, like, I'd like to pull this up and just get a little taste.
I probably more of like the pop EDM. I mean, like old school Griffin, GRYFFIN. His wife, Stephanie, actually went to Walton, where we went to high school.
That's right.
And so he's just a great person. You know, like Seven Lions, Illenium. But I'm a big techno girl.
Okay.
So like I love melodic techno, like Tale of Us, RG, Mind Against.
So Griffin, Best Is Yet to Come.
Best Is Yet to Come. Great song.
All right, let's hear it.
That's kind of his old school stuff. His style's changed a lot.
Yeah?
Yeah. But then, like, you get into, like, the hard techno.
Who's the hard techno?
I mean, there's tons of them. But, I mean, you can go to Charlotte DeWitt. You can go to Indira Paganato. And that's like more of the like true, like, you know, Berlin style techno music that I love so much.
Right there.
Yeah. That's like more of your, like, you know,
these people are loving it out here.
Techno's huge.
Yeah.
We have a great techno scene in Atlanta at Underground. So,
hey, I dig it.
Yeah.
I dig it. So I listen to music all the time. When I'm working out, driving, is this kind of music where you can always be kind of jamming out to it, or is it strictly kind of festival stuff?
No, I listen to it when I work out. I listen to it in the office, when I'm writing briefs, like on my AirPods. I listen to it when I'm driving, like all the time.
Love it. Love it. Well, keep enjoying it. Keep going. I think that's great. Take it to cool places. Anytime you can mix a hobby with travel, I am all in.
Although the last festival I was at, Ultra in Miami in March, this 19-year-old came up to me and she was like, "How old are you?" She was like a friend of a friend's like girlfriend. And she was like 19 years old. I was like, "Oh my God." And I was like, "I'm 37. She was like, "Oh, and you're still raving?" And I was like, "Oh my gosh." I was like, "I want to die." But no, like literally, I mean, there's these two famous like grandparents, like the rave grandmas who like are at every Armin van Buuren show. And like he brings them on stage, like there's no age limit. Like just because you're a certain age doesn't mean you stop liking a certain kind of music. Like it's ridiculous.
So funny you said rave, because that's what comes in my mind, the word we used back in the day.
Yeah.
Is that still what it is?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
A lot of times it has a negative connotation. People are like, "Oh, raves, drugs.
Drugs, you know, like, that kind of stuff." Yeah.
Sure. There are people doing drugs just like there are people doing drugs at country concerts or, you know, any type of show or something. But that's not everyone. And most people don't, you know? So it's really, I mean, there's sober ravers. I'm not out doing drugs at all these festivals. Like, it's right. That's not like my, if it's your thing, great. It's not my thing. And, you know, you don't have to do that. And I think people have this like connotation, like, "Oh, if you love this type of music, like clearly you're on drugs." Like, or clearly you just really like the music. So like, I mean,
yeah. Yeah. You know. Yeah. I went to Morgan Wallen with my daughter. There are people clearly doing drugs.
100%.
That's not
why. Or very intoxicated.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly right. This was great.
Yeah.
Good stuff. It was so good to connect and talk about the old times. And I'm very proud of you, how you were. You're killing it, man. That's great. So
proud of you too.
Good for you. People that are listening that are saying, "Hey, this is somebody we need in our life. If a pellet case comes up and they need you, how do they find you?"
You can email me. Alyssa, ELISSA, .Haynes, HAYNES, @ fmglaw.com, or go to the FMG website. You can find my page there. It has my phone number, contact, all that good stuff. But yeah, connect with me. I'm happy to see if I can
help. How about the socials? LinkedIn, best place to follow you?
Probably LinkedIn, yeah.
Okay.
Send me a message.
So Lindsay Fourlines was in here last week. I did a whole thing with her about how she spelled her name.
Uh-huh.
S-A-Y.
Uh-huh.
And like why that was. I have a hard time spelling Lindsay.
Oh, yeah.
Your name, too, gets all jacked up.
Yeah.
You're with an I.
No, E-L-I-S-S-A.
Or Y-E-L-L-Y-S-S-A.
And so mine's E-L-I-S-S-A because my grandfather was Eli, E-L-I, and so I'm named after him.
She gave the exact same answer.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. Lindsay was her grandfather's name, and it was a male spelled name with the A.
Yeah.
I love it. So my middle name is Sims, which is my mom's maiden name. So I love hearing about like names.
The only other Alyssa spelt like me are also, so I'm Jewish, and most of the Alyssa spelt the way mine is are also Jewish, which I find interesting. I don't know the connection there, but yeah.
You should go find a club of Alyssa's spelled name with your spelled your way. They have that like Kevin or James. Have you seen that? It's like all the Kevins or all the James will go meet up in like a bar in Texas.
And serious?
Like, oh yeah. They have that. It's like, hi, we're all Kevins here. It's like, okay. Cool. Sounds great. Interesting. Nice to meet you, Kevin. I'm Kevin, too. Anyway, and we digress.
Yeah.
Well, listen, everybody, thank you all for listening. If you enjoyed this, like I know you did, please give us a 5-star rating, leave a comment, do what you got to do. But we appreciate your time. And as always, keep chopping.